Thanks, Brother Max, and good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Lovely to be with you again as we continue our studies on Micah. And just to sort of, again, get us back in the headspace that is Micah, there's our summary of Micah in one sentence, the sort of the high-level 30,000-foot view. Godlessness brings consequences, but God will complete his purpose with those who listen and turn back to him. And that, of course, as we've seen in our studies up to now, has been the message that comes out over and over again. God wants people to respond. That's the purpose of Micah being here. That's the purpose of the prophecy, for that response. And that same desire for response, of course, is just as applicable for us now as it was for those in Micah's time. So again, just getting our sort of chronological bearings. There's the excerpt that shows when Micah prophesied, so around 740-ish through to 700-ish BC, that time of great international and domestic disturbance. So we've got all those major things happening, the end, effectively, of Syria, so far as the superpower is concerned, the rise of Assyria, the end of the northern kingdom. Massive changes. And of course, Mike is navigating this whole section with all the consequent impacts that that has. And as we saw in our class last week, even that great stomping feet of Assyria were going to make their way up towards Jerusalem and be sort of right at the gates of Jerusalem. And that was prophesied about, of course, in the first prophecy. It actually came to pass some sort of 30-odd years later. And as Brother Max has pointed out, the three-part structure of Micah, each part being neatly beginning with this call to hear. Hear, all ye people, hear, O heads of Jacob, and then, God willing, over the next couple of weeks, we'll cover off the last of those sections. So tonight, we're looking at this one, the heads of Jacob. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, you beauty, this is where I can sort of doze off because I'm not a head or whatever the case might be, bad news, because the reality is this is applicable to us all. Sure. There were in those days and there are in our times, there's sort of formal positions of accountability that might be exist within an ecclesial structure as they did there. But the simple reality is, and the point that God is at pains to emphasise, is that every one of us, every single one of us, has accountability as a leader. And we know that's the case, don't we? Think of the symbology that God uses for an ecclesia. It's made up of sheep and shepherds, and at one and the same time, we're in both categories, aren't we? We are at one and the same time both sheep and we play the role of a shepherd. And those roles may vary a little bit depending, what particular manifestation or practicality it might be. Might be in a home environment. Might be in a Sunday school environment. It could be in a class environment. So whatever it is, it doesn't matter. We all have an accountability and God looks to all his sheep, all his children, to step up and to take on and embrace a role of spiritual leadership in the context that is applicable as it sort of manifests itself. And so therefore, these are relevant. So if you're thinking you had it easy and you could sort of just point the frown at everyone else who was in a sort of leadership position, bad news, the gaze must go internal to us all. Now, we're not going to get through the whole of this section tonight. You can see it's three chapters, 3, 4, and 5. And quite interestingly, as we've seen in the previous sections, each one has a judgment section, each one has a deliverance section. But this particular one has a disproportionately large deliverance section. It's interesting, isn't it? The judgment section of the second part is relatively small. Jared read that for us. It's 12 verses. And then you get two fairly lengthy chapters, which are on the deliverance part. And we want to spend, we'll get some of it covered off tonight, and then, God willing, we'll cover off the rest of it in our next class. So, we begin our section in Micah chapter 3. And you'll notice that there's immediately a slight difference from the other beginnings of the sections. See, in chapter 1, when he begins the first part, he goes straight into it in verse 2, doesn't he? Hear, all ye people. In chapter 6, when he has the last part, similarly, hear ye now what Yahweh says. Verse 2, hear ye, O mountains. But you get a slight difference in chapter 3. He adds the, and I said, hear, I pray you, O heads of Jacob. And that's sort of interesting, isn't it? It's probably the best indication that we have that what we actually have in the prophecy of Micah is not a sort of, I'm not sure if this is quite right, the right word, but I'll use it anyway. It's not sort of a contemporaneous type account that's recorded as Micah was speaking and as the words came out of his mouth, someone was furiously writing them down. What we've actually got in the prophecy of Micah is, if you like, the reflections post the prophecy period. So Micah gave his prophecies. We know that he gave the prophecies over an extensive period of time, 30 to 40 years, over three different kings, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. And what we get in these seven chapters of Micah is essentially it's like the best of, you know, type of thing. So, you know, we get the compiled section. And that's sort of useful to know because, I mean, we know every word in Scripture is relevant and important, but particularly in a prophecy like Micah where we have it compiled and we have such a specific and formal framework that the prophecy sits in, it emphasises that. There's not a word wasted. There's a particular way that the prophecy, as it's recorded here, has been constructed because God, through Micah, wants us to be able to recollect the message that's coming through here. Hence, we have the clarity around the structure. Hence, we have the specific portions of the prophecy given to different parts within the ecclesia. And that structure, that clear structure that exists, is, again, there's like a subsection that is particularly clear in chapter 3. So, the first part of chapter 3, which is the whole of the chapter, chapter 3 verse 1 to 12, in itself breaks down into clear subsections. And those clear subsections are self-evident when you read it. The first bit, verses 1 to 4, is a particular message to the secular leaders. You see that? It's the heads of Jacob, the princes of the house of Israel. So these were like the secular leaders. And then in verses 5 to 8, he turns particularly to the prophets. Thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets. Actually, 5 to 7, really. And then in verses 9 to 12, he goes back and looks at all the leadership, the heads, the princes, the priests, and the prophets. So you can sort of see what he's doing there. He's singling out the different elements, the secular leaders, the prophets, and then the whole lot, including the priests. And it's interesting because they were all causing enormous carnage so far as the people were concerned. But they were going about their carnage in different ways. And that's where the great lesson is. Their modus operandi was different between the different groups. Not necessarily self-evident. You know, if you were an external observer there, you wouldn't think that they were achieving the same nefarious ends so far as God's people are concerned. But, as Mike is going to point out, they were. The end result was the same so far as they were concerned, and so far as the impact on the people was concerned as well. And there's a great lesson, as we'll see as we work through this, a great lesson. Destruction doesn't always come in just one form, does it? Spiritual destruction doesn't always just come in one form. And we have to be collectively and individually aware of the different formats that it has and be on our lookout to assist our brothers and sisters and make sure that we're standing up for what is right. So, what about these leaders in chapter 3, verse 1?
Well,
God starts with an expectation on them, isn't it? The end of verse 1. Is it not for you to know judgment, says God? There was a particular responsibility, so far as God was concerned, that these leaders had. The ISV puts it this way. It says, you should know justice, should you not? So it sort of poses it as a bit of a question. Now, that's your job, to know justice. But whether they understood justice as a theory or not, Micah goes on to clearly say that there was no application of it. And you see that in verse 2. This is their understanding of justice. Verse 2, who hates the good and loves the evil. Hate the good and love the evil. It's an interesting theme. Those who hate good and love evil. Come with me to Psalm 52. And I come across a classic individual who fits this category. Psalm 52. And we're in no doubt as to who this individual is, because the superscription of Psalm 52 tells us. Maskil, a psalm of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said unto him, David is come to the house of Ahimelech. And we remember the story there. They remember that? So David's fleeing from Saul and he goes, don't know where to go, ends up at the tabernacle. And of course we know the story there. He's given Goliath's sword and he eats of the old showbread that's there, and all the while Doeg is watching. Remember the story there? Doeg is watching. And this is David's perspective of someone who is in the same category as the leaders. And of course, Doeg was a leader, wasn't he? He was the chief herdman under Saul. So, enormous position from a spiritual perspective. He's typical of like a shepherd in the ecclesia. Doeg the Edomite.
Seriously.
Shepherd. And what was he like? Verse 1, Psalm 52. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of Baal endureth continually. Here you've got this contrast. Here's this man who's boasting in what he can achieve against the truth. Contrasted, of course, with God. Thy tongue deviseth mischiefs like a sharp razor. Remember that? Working deceitfully. And here it comes. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. And look at what David picks up, because we're going to see this featuring. It's the same characteristics that Micah is going to pick up in Micah chapter 3. He has a tongue like a sharp razor. Obviously loves evil more than good. Prefers lying to righteousness. That was a problem with the heads, wasn't it? Aren't you supposed to know righteousness? Aren't you supposed to know judgment? Devouring words. You know, we know the story of Doeg. What was the end result of Doeg's performance, his actions, at the end of that incident? Now he goes back to Saul. Saul has a little cry. There's no one's telling him about, you know, what this nasty David's doing. And Doeg says, where? Oh, he saw that son of Jesse. And he exposes the priest. And then what ends up happening? Complete injustice. Complete injustice. So there's a key word, isn't it? Picked up in Micah. Injustice. The innocent are suffering. The high priest innocent. The priest are innocent. Not just them. Their families. Not just their families. The whole of the inhabitants. Kills the lot. One gets away. Injustice. Violence. He ticks that box, doesn't he? Saul calls to the young men, go and kill the priest. We can't do that. God's people. Die. Kill him. With pleasure. Blood running down as he executes that violent act. Injust violence and personal gain. Who gains from Doeg's enthusiastic exhibition of ungodliness? Why Doeg? Because he gets to spoil all the goodies that existed there in the city of Nob. So you've got this piece that comes out of the life of Doeg of injustice, of violence, and of personal gain. All right, remember those things. We're going to see that they are the key elements. That's the warning. That's the warning that God puts up in lights and says, watch out. Injustice, violence, personal gain. Come over to Amos. Amos also picks up this theme very well. Amos chapter 5. Now, Amos is only 30 or so years earlier than Micah. So he's a similar era prophet. Same sort of lifetime period. Amos was prophesying to Israel, to the tribes in the north. And as we've seen in our classes, there's a similarity between what happened and the sort of degradation, as it were, for the tribes in the north, the northern kingdom, being replicated by the southern kingdom. And so in Amos chapter 5, here comes the warning about the people in the northern kingdom, and see the similarities here as well. Verse 11, Amos chapter 5. For as much therefore as your treading is upon the poor, and you take from him burdens of wheat, you've built houses of hewn stone. See the picture that's there? Here you've got these people that can't afford it, that are carrying the burden of people in positions of power who are using that for their own ends. God says, you're not going to live in those houses. You're planting all these jazzy vineyards. You're not going to eat of the fruit of it. I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. Here it comes. They afflict the just. So there you go, injustice. They take a bribe. Personal gain. They turn aside the poor in the gate from their right. So you've got this affliction of the just, so this violence, injustice, violent injustice, personal gain. And so bad is it in Amos's prophecy that he says in verse 13, therefore the prudent shall keep silence in that time, for it's an evil time. I was like, this is so bad that no one can even speak up against it. There's even those who know what's right have to keep silence. Because this sort of tidal wave of violent oppression is happening to the people. And so he goes on, verse 14. Seek good and not evil. There it is. There's the sort of antidote. Seek good and not evil, that ye may live. And so Yahweh, the God of hosts, shall be with you as you have spoken. Hate the evil and love the good. Establish judgment in the gate. It may be that Yahweh Elohim of hosts will be gracious unto the remnant of Joseph. So it's the same issues, isn't it? This sort of summary by those who love the evil and hate the good. Just come sort of for our last sort of quote to look at the opposite of that. Come to Isaiah chapter 7. Now Isaiah 7, of course, is particularly relevant for a couple of reasons. It's relevant because Isaiah was the contemporary prophet to Micah. So while Micah is prophesying in the hill country, as we've seen, down in Morasheth, down in that sort of Shephelah piece, you've got Isaiah, who's essentially prophesying in the court of the king over this period of time as well. And their prophecies are meshing in together. They're saying the same thing. So it's applicable from that point of view, but it's also applicable because, as we know, Isaiah 7 is talking about the promise of one to come. the promise of one to come. And who is that one that's coming? Verse 10. Moreover, Yahweh spake again unto Ahaz, saying, ask thee a sign of Yahweh thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz, because he's just the worst king ever, said, I will not ask, neither will I tempt Yahweh. And you can almost feel the frustration, can't you, of God. Feel the frustration. Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will ye weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name God with us. Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. There it is, isn't it? That's the ruler. So Micah talks about those leaders in his day who loved the evil and hated the good. And we're going to see how that manifests itself. We saw in Psalm 52 that Doeg, a leader, hated the good and loved the evil. And we saw how that manifested itself to the priests at Nob and the people that lived there. We see the warning that Amos gives the northern tribes to say, you're in the same space, you're afflicting the poor, violent, self-gain, you're taking a bribe. And in the context, all of those contexts of leadership, Isaiah says, the good news is, Emmanuel's coming. The leader is coming. And this leader is the opposite. He's the opposite. He refuses the evil. He chooses the good. That's why he's the leader. Because the summary of this particular leader, the Lord Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, God with us, is that his focus is not towards himself, but to others. And you can see that same consequence of their leadership in Micah, if we come back to Micah chapter 3. Because we're going to have a look in just a section at the detail under each of the segments that Micah chapter 3 is split into. But every single one of them, whether they're the secular leaders, whether they're the prophets, or whether they're the priests, have the same motivation. The same motivation. And the motivation is given for us in verse 11. Micah 3 verse 11. What is their motivation? The heads thereof judge for reward. The priests thereof teach for hire. And the prophets thereof divine for money. There's their motivation. Self-gain. So they go about it different ways. Their manifestation of self-centeredness appears in different ways. But at the end of the day, their driving motivation is exactly the same. Self-gain. Every one of them is motivated by self-gain. And yeah, that's where you stand here in 2024 and wave our arms around and say, isn't that terrible? And yes, there's the warning for us, isn't it? What motivates us as we work within the ecclesia? Because as we're going to see, the scalpel-like clarity of Micah's prophecy, which exposes their true motivation as self-gain, was not necessarily as obvious as that if you were a bystander looking at what was going on. But let's have a look at the different ways, the different mechanisms that these leaders went about to achieve their desired outcome of self-gain. So the first of the groups was the princes, the secular leaders, verses 1 through 4. And their defining characteristic is violence. Violence. Look at verses 2 and 3. It's like a sort of hyperbole, isn't it? God's creating this, and it's sort of hidden somewhat by the AV language because it's all very old English-like. But look at what God's actually saying here in verses 2 to 3. This is what these leaders, these secular leaders, were doing to the people so far as God was concerned. You hate the good and love the evil. So, okay, how does that happen? You pluck off their skin from off them. Cool. Pretty serious. That's the kind of thing the Assyrians did. Skinning them alive. But that's not all. Their flesh from off their bones. So they picture this mental image. Here's these leaders, these people that should have known judgment, and they're peeling away the skin off the people, that they're there to have a position of leadership, a position of self-sacrifice, and instead they're peeling their skin off. And then they're ripping the flesh from off the bones. Who also, verse 3, eat the flesh of my people and slay their skin from off them. It's like they're going over it in great detail. Then that's not enough. You're left with this skinned, defleshed skeleton, and then they break their bones, and then they chop them in pieces, and then they're sticking them in the pot. They're boiling them up within the cauldron. It's pretty graphic language, isn't it? Pretty graphic language. They're getting every bit out of them that they can. That's a picture that's there. No concern for the people. Total concern for what they can extract from the people. Such a violent picture that's being portrayed there. It's almost overwhelming. Now, it's not just enough to kill them. It's a frenzy of violence. Not just enough to take their stuff. They have to take every last bit, even down to boiling the bones. Now, as physically violent a period of time as the times of the Assyrians were, that wasn't literally happening so far as leadership is concerned within the nation of Judah. And the trick we can fall into, perhaps, is we can look at that and say, oh, well, we don't do that. I can't even think of the last time I killed someone, we might think to ourselves. Doesn't apply to me. Come with me to Galatians chapter 5. You know, what we're getting here is we're getting God's perspective. Remember that piece I said? If you were looking from, you know, if you were just an observer, transported back in time, and you were just meandering around, you wouldn't see people, you wouldn't see the leaders in Judah literally skinning their brothers and sisters. You wouldn't see them literally ripping off their flesh or cutting their bones up and then throwing them into a pot. But you might see what Paul describes in Galatians chapter 5. Have a look at verse 15. If you bite and devour one another, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. You know, Paul in Galatians, as we know, he's not talking about people literally eating. He's not talking about cannibalism physically, is it? It's not saying, oh, by the way, be careful when you come in because a doorman might take a good bite of you as you walk through. But that's how he describes it. Can you see that Paul in Galatians chapter 5 is using the same symbology as Micah's use it? He's describing, within an ecclesial environment, people turning into spiritual cannibals, not cannonballs. That's what he's describing. Friction within the ecclesia. That's what it's talking about. Look at verse 12. There's people that trouble them. Verse 12. Verse 13. Believers are using the truth to serve their own ends. See, for brethren, you've been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. So what Paul's saying is when we're serving ourselves within the ecclesia, when we're creating friction within the ecclesia, when we're doing something for our self-gain in whatever that might be, when we are, to use his words in verse 13, creating an occasion to the flesh, then in verse 15, we're engaging in spiritual cannibalism. So he says, bit harsh. Well, that's how God sees it. So whilst for people walking through the areas of Judah in Micah's time, and everything's fine, the leaders are there, and they look like pretty good leaders, they look like they care about the people, God says, you're ripping their skin off. You're stripping off their flesh. You're grinding them up and turning them into soup. And Paul goes on in Galatians 5 in words we know extremely well, isn't it? If you're not sure whether or not if we're thinking like this, and let's face it, it's probably something that it's easy for us all to slip into. He says, I'll give you some little clues. Verse 19. How do we know if we're giving occasion to the flesh? Well, verse 19. Now, the works of the flesh are manifest. They're made open. They're exposed. So are we making an occasion for the flesh, which God equates to spiritual cannibalism? If you're not sure, here's the little text, because these are the works of the flesh, which are clear. And then he lists them off. As the ESV puts it, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery. They're all a bit extreme. Yeah, I can sort of see how some of them would be a bit like spiritual cannibalism. The list goes on. Enmity. Strife. Jealousy. Anyone been jealous? It's the work of the flesh, says Paul. Fits of anger. Now it starts to bite, doesn't it? Sure, there might be some things in that list that we say, we haven't done that before, but really, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies and things like these. I warn you as I warned you before that those who do such things, says Paul, will not inherit the kingdom of God. I reckon they're such powerful words, aren't they? Because we can sometimes feel ourselves so divorced from the issue that afflicted the leaders in Micah's time. Very much we're not like that. Paul tells us in Galatians 5, actually, naturally, we're closer to that state than what we might think. The second group of leaders or heads in Micah chapter 3, well, their manifestation of self-gain is slightly different. Let's have a look at those. They're in verses 5 through 7. Thus saith Yahweh concerning the prophets that make my people err. That bite with their teeth and cry peace. And he that putteth not into their mouths, they even prepare war against him. It's difference, isn't it? Did you see the difference between the two? That there's something perhaps even more tricky about these prophets. Whilst we're getting the hyperbole view, whilst we're getting the uncluttered view, we're getting the God's perspective with all the trappings of diplomacy and decency stripped away, and it's just back to the raw piece. When we looked at that with the secular heads, they weren't making anyone err, were they? They were ultimately just going for their own good. But when you come to the prophets, they're a little bit different. There's a little difference. There's a subtle difference. God says, you know what? I've got a big problem with you, prophets. You cause others to err. The secular heads, they were just erring and chasing their own things. But the prophets made people err. And how did they make people err? Because, middle of verse 5, they cry peace. We say, well, that's a good thing. But it's not if it's not true, is it? It's not if it's not true. And the impact of these false prophets prophesying peace when there wasn't peace is just as destructive as the violent princes that Mike has just described. So we can all see how violent they are when they're chomping up people and boiling up their bones and cooking up a soup. It's really easy to see. It's not so easy to see how violent, how destructive it is when someone's prophesying peace, is it? But they make the people err. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because did you see how they're described in verse 5? They bite with their teeth. That word bite there, Hebrew norshak or something like that, Strong says it's a primitive root to strike with a sting as a serpent. How do you like that? So to strike as a serpent. Well, we can't miss the point, can we? We can't miss that point. It's exactly the same warning as we saw in Micah chapter 2. Exactly the same warning in Micah 2. Yeah, whilst it seems unkind when we stand for the truth, the true destruction comes when we tell the same lie that the serpent told. That's where the true destruction comes, as we made the point in the last class. Yeah, whilst it seems really nice to say, you're not going to die, thou shalt not surely die, it seems a whole lot nicer than in the day that thou diest, the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Yeah, you look at him and say, well, that's, I far prefer that thou shalt not die. But the point is, it's wrong. And the consequence of that wrong teaching is that it's like a serpent's bite, and it causes the people to err. It's such a powerful picture, isn't it? And that's the problem that the prophets in Micah's time were doing. They were essentially giving the people what they wanted. To be, again, it's sort of hard to pick it up in the authorised version here, and there's probably a few people with different translations that will get easier, but essentially, they're prophesying depending on what personal gain they were getting from it. So if someone was feeding them what they wanted, they'd prophesy great things to them. Lies, but boy, they sounded good. What the people wanted to hear. Like a serpent sting, ultimately leading to death. If they didn't get any gain, well, they'd prophesy bad things. Great warning, isn't it? Great warning for us. And the outcome's the same. So the secular leaders ended up with self-gain, giant soup, bowl, delicious food, at the expense of the faithful believers of the ecclesia. And the prophets ended up with what they wanted as well. We just prophesy for reward. Made a fortune telling people what they want to hear. It's like the teachers having itching ears concept, isn't it, that Paul picks up in Timothy. Different ways, different methodologies, same outcome. God's true justice is undermined. The outcome is violent. And it's all done in the pursuit of self-gain. No different from Doeg, no different from the people who were in Amos's time. It's the same core elements that exist. Yeah, you know, verse 8 of Micah is an interesting insertion, isn't it? We brought this one up in our first class, if you may remember, because you know, it's this little personal reflection piece that Micah has. You can see him in the prophecy. We saw it in chapter 1 as well. And he's giving this piece, and you can see him getting, you know, they're talking about the prophets. Micah's a prophet. So you can imagine that, you know, if you're a prophet, you're saying, you know, and the prophets do this, They cause the people to err. They're like a serpent biting. And Micah feels compelled to add in a personal reflection in verse 8. See that? Truly, says Micah, I'm full of power by the Spirit of Yahweh and of judgment and might to clear unto Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. So it's almost like Micah feels this need to interrupt the flow of the prophecy and re-establish his credentials as a faithful prophet of God. And you get this real contrast, don't you, between Micah and these heads of Jacob, specifically the prophets that are there. Micah is full of power by the Spirit of Yahweh, but they're not going to have a vision. See, that's the consequence that God had said to them, isn't it? Verse 6, you're not going to have a vision. You're going to call out, you're going to want my intervention, you're going to want to understand what it is that I've revealed, and I'm not going to show it to you, says God. Micah understands God's judgment. The heads have no idea. Micah is able to speak God's words of might, but what about them? They're not speaking God's words of might. They're speaking their own words of might, is it? They pluck, they eat, they flay, they break, they chop. And Micah is there to declare unto Jacob his transgression, to Israel his sin. But unfortunately, those false prophets were there for their own ends. And in the process of pursuing their own ends, they made God's people err. They cried peace because it suited their own ends. Yeah, it's such a practical warning for us, isn't there, from the behaviour and the consequent judgment on these heads. Because you know, in a way, the two different methodologies sort of sum up the sort of classic different methodologies that we can be guilty of in ecclesial life as well, isn't it? Pursue getting our own ends through the demonstration of authority or force like the princes. Okay, maybe we're not twisting people's arms, but maybe we're little bit of, what would you call it, nepotism perhaps? A little bit of juggling the numbers before we get into committee meetings to achieve the outcomes that we want. Engagement in a bit of strife, sowing a bit of dissension maybe, perhaps a bit of envy that we might have. Fits of anger, remember they're all the words that Paul picks up and says, there, that's eating, that's devouring, that's spiritual cannibalism. Just don't say that, you know, we're not just talking about little things here. That's chopping up our brothers and sisters in God's view. Getting the pot going and boiling them up. So that's one way we can be guilty of. Or we can water down the true sayings of God, can't we? Because that makes them more acceptable, makes us more acceptable, makes us perhaps more popular in a world that, you know, is got its very humanistic way of thinking. There's more in it for us if we make God's word be what people are wanting as opposed to what God's saying. And that can manifest itself in all kinds of ways, isn't it? You know, God wouldn't expect us to. We can't help it if we're ... It's a warning, isn't it? Prophets who prophesied peace, like a serpent's bite. We can be guilty of the same godlessness as the heads of the people in Micah chapter 3. And yeah, warning is, and it's a pretty potent warning, if we don't change, if we don't respond to God's call, if we don't sort of adjust, then we can expect similar consequences as they face, isn't it? God turning his face from them. See that in verse 4? God turning his face from them. So these leaders are going to cry out, and yet God's not even hearing them. They don't even exist so far as God is concerned. But we don't, you know, how disastrous is that? God blinding them from seeing the truths he's revealed. Ultimately, their destruction. And that, again, is why here you've got Micah prophesying. And, of course, this prophecy is being given in the times, the latter end of Ahaz's period of time and the beginning of Hezekiah's reign. We know that. We'll see that in just a minute. But, yeah, if you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, I can't really see the application to myself. Well, don't worry, because neither could the leaders in Micah's time. They couldn't see it applying to themselves either. Have a look at verse 11. Can you see their disbelief? So Micah says, you're all motivated by self-gain. The heads are judging for reward. The priests are teaching for hire. The prophets divide for money. And yet here the heads say, they say, hang on. We lean upon Yahweh. We're relying on God. This doesn't apply to us. We rely on God. They can even quote Scripture, can't they? They can quote Scripture. Is not Yahweh among us? Well, we looked at that quote just before, didn't we? Emmanuel, God with us. So they're saying, we're relying on God. We're leaning on God. God's with us. It's been prophesied. Isaiah's prophesying it. But spiritual deception doesn't change reality. We might be deceived, but reality remains reality. God finishes this section in verse 12 with a great warning. Great as in dire, not great as in good. Look at verse 12. Therefore shall Zion for your sake be ploughed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house as the high places of the forest. Oh, here they were, these people that said they relied on God, they leant on God. These people that couldn't see how the description of the secular leaders and the description of the prophets and the priests, that's nothing like what we are. And God says, I'm calling on you to change. Now, if you can remember, this bit, verse 12 of Micah chapter 3, we find somewhere else in the Bible. Come back to Jeremiah 26. We looked at this before, so I won't spend an enormous amount of time here. But Jeremiah 26, which is, of course, a record of the discussion that happened in Jeremiah's time, when Jeremiah had been warning all the people and the leaders of his time against their lack of godliness. And they're trying to kill Jeremiah. Remember, we saw that before, didn't we? Verse 11. The priests, the prophets, and the princes. Hey, that's a funny thing, isn't it? Exactly the same groups. They say, this man is worthy to die, for he has prophesied against the city, as we've heard with the ears. And as we saw before, Jeremiah's like, well, you do what you want. It's not going to change what God does. I'm in your hand, verse 14. But know for certain that if you put me to death, you're going to bring this innocent blood. And then they have a change of heart, don't they? And we saw this before. Verse 18. Micah the Morathite prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And he spake to all the people of Judah, saying, thus saith Yahweh of hosts. Now, if you've got Micah chapter 3 open, you can sort of flick between the two. And you can see here that this section they're quoting is Micah 3 verse 12. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Zion shall be ploughed like a field. There it is. Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house is the high places of a forest. Then in Jeremiah 26, did Hezekiah, king of Judah, and all Judah put him and all to death? Did he not fear Yahweh and besought Yahweh, and Yahweh repented him of the evil which he had pronounced against them? Thus might we procure great evil against our own souls. So, what do we learn from that? Well, we learn that as Micah is giving this prophecy in Micah chapter 3, and he, let's face it, he's dead. He's been reasonably to the point, hasn't he? Hasn't minced matters. Who's listening? Well, it's Hezekiah. I mean, personally, I think this prophecy was, we're getting the sort of condensed version of the prophecy, and it was a prophecy probably given over Ahaz's period of time as well, because it's over a period of time. But the summarised version comes to us here, and the summarised version in verse 12, it's Hezekiah we're seeing. And what does Hezekiah do? He doesn't get all uppity, does he? He doesn't start pulling out all the examples of how godly he'd been and how dare Micah dare say that and what proof did he have anyway, and he didn't say that. He appeals to God. He responds. And even the people in Jeremiah's time could see that the consequence of Hezekiah's response, a response in humility, a response in taking ownership of the issues that existed, him taking ownership of the issues that were manifesting themselves in other people, not just himself, probably not even himself, but he takes that on board as the faithful of all ages, works together with the people, and God changes his mind. What a wonderful thing. Changes his mind. And Hezekiah becomes this magnificent first fulfillment, we might call it, of the great leader that is to come. The great leader that is to come. It's a beautiful section in here. And I'm looking at the clock, and I think we might leave it here for tonight, and then, God willing, next week we're going to, because that's the end of our judgment section, and then we're going to start this chapters 4 and 5, where we'll look at the deliverance section. And yeah, I guess just as the teaser to get your brains all ready and firing away on this, think about the whole of chapter 3 in the context of poor leadership, self-centered leadership, for self-gain, violent and unjust. That's why chapters 4 and 5 describe the complete opposite. They describe Emmanuel. They describe God with us. They describe the one who is completely devoted to good and will completely shun the evil. And that's the one that we can look forward to picking up that part in our second section of our second prophecy next week, God willing.